America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. We have schisms about the isms, populism, nationalism, and socialism. These political ideologies are all in play in the volatile mix in today's America, as center-left President Joe Biden tries to navigate these choppy political waters, many others are fanning extremist flames in search of political advantage. If you're confused about where things stand, or even where you stand in this mix, we'll try to sort things out today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is John Judas, and he has been with us before, and he is an eminent political scholar, and he's written a book called The Politics of Our Time, and it deals with populism, nationalism, and socialism. Now, John, help us understand, because you've been on before, I believe it was around the book, The Nationalist Revival, but you have also written The Populist Explosion and The Socialist Awakening, and now you've compiled all three, and you're really trying to help us understand the various currents of political thought at this time.
Yes, I am. And is there a question about that in the offing?
Well, I'm asking, is that possible? There's so much here to unpack.
Well, I just do the U.S. and Europe. If somebody asked me a question about China or Uruguay or Ethiopia, I wouldn't be able to answer. So I still have a fairly limited scope in terms of my understanding.
Well, which of the isms concerns you the most at this moment in time?
What I say about the present time is that we are in a peculiar kind of lull, a kind of eye of the hurricane that is brought about by the pandemic and by the combined pandemic and recession, where in a lot of these countries, the electorate has put its leadership in the hands of, either older trusted people or technocrats. You know, we have a 78-year-old president who was elected to the Senate in the early 70s. Angela Merkel is still in control in Germany. Macron in France is a technocrat. Boris Johnson, been around many, many years, two-term mayor of London. So the populist upsurge has, to some extent, been quieted. I mean, that's partly the result, too, of what the pandemic's done for immigration, because all the countries have closed their borders, and immigration is way down. And that was one of the sparks that lit the fire in both the United States and Europe. The question is what's gonna happen next? What will happen afterwards? France has an election in 2022. Germany also. In the United States, this next congressional election in 2022 will be very important, because what Biden has done is really given that we have to go towards a big government and major government intervention into the economy, he's moved pretty far to the left in terms of what he's doing. You could say Trump was the right-wing version of what we would get, plus the authoritarianism after November. Whether we continue that will really depend upon whether the Democrats can retain control of Congress. If they don't, we're going to be back, I think, into this situation of unstable equilibrium where one party after another takes control and undoes what the previous has done, and where people become very frustrated with stagnation and standstill in Washington.
When we look at Joe Biden as a candidate, he might have been the only Democrat who actually could have beaten Donald Trump. He stayed in the center and then moved a little bit to the left later on in the campaign. But during the primary season, he really hugged the center and said that he needed that blue wall to be reestablished. And you talk about the fact that he had a certain concept, a certain economic nationalism that was not that totally different from Donald Trump. Talking to some of those disaffected, deindustrialized workers of the Midwest and trying to reestablish dominance for the Democrats in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. What do you see from him on that score as to adopting some of this populism, if you will?
I was very happy to see Biden embrace it. You could say, again, a center-left version of American nationalism. I mean, as I argued in that book, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with nationalism, and people have to have faith in their own citizenry and believe that we can do things as Americans. And we've had left-wing nationalists like Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt, and we've had our right-wing, and chiefly the guy who just left office, Trump. And one of the things that Biden has done, which is in really, again, in contrast to Trump, who undid everything that Obama had his hands in, is he's kept alive, not again the toxic spirit of America First, but what was positive and constructive about it. He has a Made in the USA commission that he established, where he's mandated federal contractors, which federal contractors is a huge amount of people who depend in part or in whole on federal money for what they do, to buy products, if at all possible, that are made in the USA, and also to not block unionization of their firms. So, again, very positive. He's kept the steel tariffs, it's going to be hard for him to do what would be necessary to really change the political dynamics in the country, which is to, he talks about build back better, to build back a lot of what's been lost in the small and mid-sized towns in the Midwest and South that have all gone Republican, because as they've lost manufacturing and mining. It's really going to be hard to do that. Most of the innovation is either in construction or high tech. So we'll see if he can do that. But in any case, he's embraced what was constructive about Trump's presidency rather than repudiating it.
How rare is it to see these various strains of populism, nationalism, and socialism existing at the same time in our body politic? I don't know if it's that unusual in Europe, and since you focus on Europe and America, because Europe has these multiple parties, so you can find your place along the spectrum. In America, we only have the two parties. Tell us what that presents as a challenge.
Well, I think if you think back, you get the 1890s and the early 1900s, you get the 1930s, and you get now. That's about it for when you really have these strong dissenting currents in American politics. And populism in particular, you always have some kind of populist parties or candidates on the fringes, but it only becomes a big deal when a significant minority of the population believes that the political leaders of both parties are not acting in their own interests. That is, in the popular in the national interest.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the situation that prevailed after the Great Recession, when there was a lot of distrust in both parties. Let's say on a subject like China, where China had really taken us to the cleaners in terms of manufacturing in the early 2000s. And there was tremendous distrust, the fact that both parties had supported China coming into the WTO under conditions which would have made it possible for them to undersell our manufacturing in the Midwest and South. So again, I think that you only get this kind of convergence when there is great disillusionment with what had been a consensus.
You say that this moment bears the markings of a genuine crisis, and you talk about it from the standpoint of Joe Biden, Angela Merkel, and Macron. You say they are all presiding over a fractured and unhappy electorate and a deeply flawed political economy. What is the political economy in the United States, and how much does inequality play into this?
I think the main feature of the political economy in the United States that has undercut our politics and created this kind of polarization is the fact that we've had tremendous growth in our cities, in these huge metropolitan areas. And at the same time, we've had a loss of industry, a loss of mining in a lot of our Midwestern, non-coastal, and also Southern towns. And that's created the basis of the kind of polarization we have. And the very same thing happens really in France, where Northern France is an area of, again, where a lot of industry has left in the last 40 years, and that's Marine Le Pen's political base. The UK, the place where Labour really started to lose out because it supported staying in the European Union, were these, again, former industrial towns. In Europe, they call them post-industrial towns. In the Midlands of England and in the North. And so in both these cases, you have a political and cultural polarization that's underlain by an economic polarization in terms of economic growth. And you know, both Boris Johnson and Biden have pledged to try to correct that, to try to even out the growth in the country. But it's going to be very hard to do. I mean, you can't, what the president can do in terms of seeding growth in different areas of the country is very limited.
It's interesting. I was interviewing Terry Moe, who's a political scientist from Stanford, and he said the only way that we are going to try to correct some of the concerns that seem to prevail in our society today is for government to work again. And I'm really wondering whether some of the responses of the government to the pandemic in terms of giving direct cash outlays, really trying to support small businesses like bars and restaurants during this period. In other words, do you sense that people on the left and the right and those who supported Donald Trump too are believing that maybe there is a role for government? Because one of the things that you say is that there are people on the right who really just don't want to see social programs expanded, and yet many of those social programs really benefit them, even though culturally they're told that they don't, that they benefit the other guy.
Well, I think we are in a period where in general, maybe let's say 60% of the electorate supports a large government intervention in the economy. We still have a lot of the old American individualism and distrust of government, and you can see that in the reaction to vaccines and masks. I mean, we're we really are not going to be able to achieve herd immunity in the country because we still have so much distrust of government, which carries over to distrust of expertise and science. So we're in a better period, but I don't know whether we've really turned the corner as far as trust in government goes.
The politics of our time. John Judas is with us. And John, you talk about three phases of political reaction to storms of events. And we've seen the Tea Party in response to what happened during the financial meltdown in 2008, Occupy Wall Street. Then, of course, we've had the pandemic. We had 9/11 preceding that. I mean, this has been a tumultuous period, to say the least. And optimism about capitalism gave way to what you call failed adjustment. And you also talk about the fact that under Joe Biden, we're entering another phase altogether. Can you delve into that a bit?
Well, I think the phase we're entering into is one where there is going to be more government intervention. And the question is whether it's going to be of a conservative or a liberal, right-wing or left-wing variety. With Trump, you really did see an enormous amount of government intervention, very strong intervention in trade, tariffs, which we, hadn't seen the imposition of tariffs except, on a very small scale for a while. The Operation Warp Speed was a trillion dollar expenditure, huge, and the Republicans ended up voting for a relief bill that was over $1 trillion right at the end of Trump's presidency. So, you saw that, but you also saw some of the dark side, the attempt to encourage industry by drastically cutting taxes and regulation. Anti-union stuff, especially in terms of federal workers, but also in terms of gig workers, people who self-contract that firms can take advantage of by not paying benefits, all these kind of things. So, that with him, you did see this big kinds of big government, but it was of a right-wing variety. And there are benign versions, I think I would say, of that now stirring up now in the Republican Party. And I would look towards somebody like Marco Rubio. I mean, I don't say that I'm support necessarily what he's doing, but I don't think you'd find with Rubio or John Kasich the stop the steal, the attempt to really undermine our democracy, which is the extreme version of this kind of right-wing big government stuff that Trump tried to pull off after the election in November.
So I do want to talk about that in a moment. But what if Joe Biden's policies don't work? I mean, if in fact this large infusion of cash into the economy, and you can certainly comment on whether you think we're reaching levels of debt that are going to be dangerous or whether in the context of our entire GDP, we can handle this with low interest rates. But if they fail, I mean, what happens then, in your view, given that we're still in this period of total, polarization, still a disbelief in government, even a disbelief in the legitimacy of our own election?
I don't think that they're going to fail in a substantive sense. I think that the economy has the wind behind it. I mean, there's an incredible amount of pent-up demand, and there'll be inflation, but not on the order that we had in the 1970s, where we had a combination of pent-up demand from the Vietnam War, but also the energy crisis and the tremendous increase in oil prices. So I don't see that as a big danger. But I do think in terms of politics that Biden could very, and Democrats could very well lose control of the House in 2022. And it really depends on the extremes of each party. In 2020, the Democrats benefited enormously from Trump being the opponent. Georgia, I don't think they would have won those two Senate seats if Trump hadn't at the same time been trying to steal the national election and going around Georgia telling people that they shouldn't believe the Republican Secretary of State. I think a lot of those suburban voters who might have voted for a moderate Republican went south because of that and voted for Democrats. In 2022, if the economy's recovered, if the big issue is something like defund the police or, you know, should boys who identify as girls be on sports teams, girls sports teams, things like that. In other words, the whole agenda of the cultural left, if that becomes foremost, the Democrats could be in trouble in a lot of these marginal seats. It just depends who's, you know, which side gets its more unpopular issues to the fore. I mean, Biden's having trouble with immigration already too, I think, with voters. But again, I think his strategy is to just put a lot of that stuff aside. It's very reminiscent of what Reagan did when he was president. I mean, there were all kinds of people who supported Reagan who wanted to reinstitute school prayer, for instance. And, you know, what Reagan would do is he would appoint a fundamentalist to be the deputy assistant secretary in Health and Human Services, and they would produce a bunch of crazy reports and stuff like that. But he himself, and he wouldn't allow the Republicans to get involved. I think Biden is trying to quiet the fires on issues like defund the police that would really make it very difficult for the Democrats in 2022. So I think the main issues are going to be political. I think there will be a recovery, and I think that Biden will benefit from that. And there'll also be the pandemic is, you know, this is a subject on which you should ask somebody who knows something. But my suspicion again is we're not going to be shut down in 2022 the way we were during the last year.
How long can everything hold together when you've still got a majority of Republicans saying that the election was rigged, trying to do these audits, some call them fraudits? You've got the Capitol insurrection being revisited already, and some saying that it was agitators on the left, not Trump supporters, which we saw with our own eyes. Those who don't accept Joe Biden as a legitimate president represent a majority in the Republican Party. I mean, how major are those issues for many of us who are moderate to liberal? We look at this and we can't believe this is actually going on. We think this is fantastical and not in a good way, not in a Disney way. I mean, what happens there to rational thinking people who thought of themselves as more conservative?
It's very scary. And it's what happened after the November election is something that I never experienced in my lifetime. And I've been around a while. In terms of those polls, about 50% of Republicans thinking Trump is still the president. Again, you have to weigh that in terms of how many people identify as Republicans now to a pollster. And if you take Gallup, it's about, you know, high 20s, maybe 30% at the very most. So again, you're talking about 15% of the electorate or so that think that way. But, you know, that's still very dangerous, especially if those people are active in politics. And I wonder how much they're sustained by Trump himself. And if he leaves the scene, if he becomes less of a power in the Republican Party, that those kind of insurrectionary elements will still be as important as they are now.
When we look at the debate that's going on, where I don't think you and I would ever have had a conversation where we would have asked the question, will autocracy triumph over democracy? And yet that's a question that serious political scientists are looking at. And the questioning of the supremacy of democracy has had more conversation than I ever imagined in my lifetime I would hear. What do you say about that debate that's going on around the world?
Oh, around the world, well, that's something else. I mean, there are, you know, China is obviously at this kind of, oh, you could say, cyber totalitarianism, where they're using the most advanced electronics, computer electronics, to spy on their own people and limit dissent. So there's a lot of scary things going on around the world. In terms of the United States, I mean, we've had something like this before in the 1890s and early 1900s, where we had on the left, we had the populists who were demanding an expansion of democracy, the direct election of senators, for instance. It used to be legislators would elect the senators. And on the right, you had the Southern racists and segregationists who were trying to disenfranchise blacks and in the process poor whites as well. So we've had this kind of tumult about our democracy before, and even the circumstances are a little similar, because, you know, what you had then were large swaths of the country that had been devoted to agriculture that were in trouble economically, and you had booming cities and towns where industry was growing. So you had this same kind of thing, and we managed to get out of it. It took 30 years in the Great Depression, really, to resolve these, but you know, we saved our democracy. So I'm hopeful that we'll be able to see now, but I think some of these states are going way off the rails, like the Republicans in Georgia and Texas and Florida and Arizona and Iowa. So we're in for a very turbulent period in terms of trying to preserve our democracy.
Well, when we look at the various reforms in terms of election law that are being intended and put forward in various states, I'd love your comments on those. Some call it suppression. But you do say, and I want to say this in a hopeful way, that Trump followers are not the stuff of a new civil war. But yet we sense that there is this desire to constrict the electorate and to try to hold on to power, even as they're becoming an anti-majoritarian minority in our country, and yet they govern a lot because of the way the Senate is set up. I mean, just explain what you see in that dynamic.
We have Democrats have won the popular vote in, what, 7 out of the last presidential elections. So, you know, if you looked at it from that standpoint, there's the emerging Democratic majority has emerged, but
which you wrote about way back.
Right. Yes, 2001. But we have a constitutional system where people get elected by states. And we also have a state electorates and local electorates where a lot of people don't participate, and where conservative money has come in and made a lot of difference, so that we have a lot of Republican legislators, and that's, you know, that's why we're in the fix we are now, where a state like Arizona is, you know, starting to tend Democratic, but its legislator and its governor are Republicans and are in a position to really screw things up. I looked at some of the legislation that's come out of the House on voting, and I'm not impressed by it. You know, the one bill, I can't remember what the name of the vote. It's not the John Lewis bill, but the big bill. It's like 900 pages long, and it has 500 different provisions. Campaign finance, Washington, D.C., a state, you know, all these kinds of things thrown in, And for each one of those, you're going to find, even among the Democrats, somebody who objects to it. I would much prefer if the Democrats went after something very similar, very simple, like Sunday voting, or making the Tuesdays of elections a national holiday, that would make it very hard for Republicans to suppress the vote. Because, you know, if you think about it, I mean, mail-in voting, if we don't have a pandemic, is not going to be a big deal. But and something like that, Sunday voting, or, you know, making it a holiday, might be the kind of thing that would really get 10 Republicans on board so you could win it in the Senate. But the bills that exist now, and particularly this 900-page one, are just not going to get anywhere. They're not going to withstand a filibuster, and I don't even know whether they would get 50 Democrats. Yes, that concerns me, because I think we desperately need political reform. And we're not going to get the end of the Electoral College. We almost got that during Nixon's first administration, but I doubt whether that's going to happen, because it's too many states. It's against their interest to support it. But we can get some kind of election reform as long as the Democrats keep it relatively simple and popular.
The book is called The Politics of Our Time. We've touched on populism, a bit on nationalism. We haven't really spoken to the issue of socialism. And, of course, the Republicans have been trying to use that to beat the Democrats over the head that they are socialists. I think even Kevin McCarthy recently, in some of his statements trying to protect one of his wayward colleagues, said that again about the socialist agenda, and they're going to try to pin that on Joe Biden. What would you say about the socialism that you talk about in the book, which is more of a social democracy, not trying to take over various forms of production, not trying to eliminate elections, but making it more of a social contract of sorts? And that's what Elizabeth Warren and others have been talking about. Where are we as we look at that movement in America, particularly in the Democratic Party?
Well, what I described in the book was something's happening primarily among young people. Support for socialism and opposition to capitalism, but the form that takes is very different from the kind of socialism that I embraced in the 60s or that people embraced in the 1930s and before. It really is a much more limited kind of transformation that is similar to advanced social democracy. In Scandinavia, for instance, where you have a very robust safety net, where people don't have to worry about losing their health insurance or their life going down the tubes if they lose a job, and where workers have more control over their jobs, over their workplaces, and even in the case of Germany, where workers are on boards of directors, on the kind of investments that companies make. So when I'd interview the kids at at Sanders rallies or even Warren rallies about socialism, I mean, they would talk about cooperation, they talk about a racial equality, economic equality, and they talk about a Medicare for all and things like that, and free college, which are things that in Europe are fairly routine, but in the United States are shockingly radical. The problem, politically and nationally, is that about more than half the electorate is still grew up in the era of the Cold War and identify socialism with the Soviet Union, Cuba, China, and now with Venezuela. And so as a rallying cry for the Democrats nationally, it's a real loser. And I think, that like Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger was right to say that the Democrats in moderate suburban districts were put in peril by the socialism and defund the police, which were two things that the left was pushing during to 2020. So again, I'm talking about a really interesting phenomenon in American politics. I don't know where it's going to go. Maybe in 20 years, people will socialism will just become another alternative, the way it has been in European countries. Or what's more likely, or maybe is even happening now, is you'll get socialist policies, but people won't call them that. They'll call, you know, Build Back Better or some, you know, some other, it'll come under some other form. And that's fine with me. I'm not wedded to the term.
Right. You said that you think it will come by a different name. In closing, you go back to the Cold War in the book, and you talk about the fact that perhaps we went a bit off the rails at that moment in time. What happened when we were the sole superpower left standing? What did we not do right? What should we learn from? And where are we in the world today as you see it?
Well, I think we got we suffered from a bout of utopian thinking in the early 1990s, when we had simultaneously the end of the Cold War, the disintegration of the Soviet Empire, China really taking a kind of what they called at the time a capitalist road, and introducing before Tiananmen Square, let's say the late 1980s, some freedoms that were unknown there before. And simultaneously, we had the internet boom in the United States. And we and the Europeans became very cocky about what was possible. And in the United States, since the days of the Puritans in the 17th century, it takes the form of thinking that we can remake the world in our image. For the Puritans, it was America is the seat of a new Israel, a basically religious, evangelical spirit. For Americans, it's more the world could become a liberal democracy, and that if we let China and Russia into the World Trade Organization, if we encourage candidates like Yeltsin in Russia, then those countries would become liberal democracies, and we'd have a peaceful world without the kind of conflict that we had before. At the same time, we did things like expanding NATO to the borders of the old Soviet Union that were just bound to inflame national sentiments there. So the war in Iraq, where we thought our soldiers would be greeted with confetti as they came into Baghdad. So we had this tremendous period of illusion. The Europeans, too, thought that once they had a currency that everybody accepted and eliminated borders between countries, there would be a convergence between the poor southern European countries and the richer northern European, and between the former communist countries in Eastern Europe and the liberal democracies of Western Europe. It didn't work out. Instead, you had splits along those lines, and they continue to this day. So, again, we're living in the wake now of all these various utopian illusions being dashed, and the question is what we're going to replace them with, what vision of a new world, and whether we can do it in a way that will ensure peace and prosperity globally.
What's the best case scenario going forward for America finding its way and calming down and getting more to the center, where America has generally survived well our politics, given the two-party system? And when is failure apparent to us, that it's just not working? Is it the development of new parties? Is it fracturing that involves states wanting to secede? I mean, what could happen here?
Well, I think nationally the best case scenario is for some kind of real revival of the parts of the country that have been left behind the last 20 or 30 years, and for a more rational immigration system that wouldn't put a lot of pressure, particularly on the unskilled workers who are already here, some kind of revival of unionization that will put that will allow workers and the in the bottom half of the income pyramid some real bargaining power. You mean you see that now even with the unemployment insurance and what that's done in terms of giving workers bargaining power. I mean, I'm not going back to a $7.25 an hour job if I can do better just staying on unemployment. Somebody says now. For Republicans, that's a crime because they want these people to go back and work at the McDonald's or, what have you, Walmart, at that kind of income. But in fact, that's a very good thing because now it's going to force these people to pay higher wages. So again, that's a kind of positive thing. Internationally, what you hope for is a cooperation. There's all these kinds of things like pandemics, climate change, that can't be dealt with individually by countries. So what we want is to have some kind of cooperation, not something utopian where a world government will replace the individual governments, but again, something that was thought that the United Nations could do. And it's possible. I mean, there's some willingness on the part of China, for instance, to cooperate on climate change. So we'll just have to see what happens. But if we don't get that, if we get continual strife, if we get airplanes being forced down, all this kind of stuff, we're going to be in for a very rocky period.
John Judas, The Politics of Our Time. Lots of important historical information in this book. Lots for you to think about different political philosophies that are now intertwined in our politics. So I really encourage you to get this book. It's a compendium of three previous put forward through the Columbia Global Reports. John, thanks again for coming.
Yeah, it was my pleasure.